It's sort of the special dimensions, like 6, 7, and 8. But today I'm gonna, so out of that project came a whole flood of ideas in general dimensions, dealing with structures which, although they're still connected to differential forms, are not generic. Somehow in the same way that Babi Yao is generic in 6 dimensions, but not in higher dimensions. So today, in the 3 lectures, I want to talk about generalized complex structures, generalized Calabi-Yau structures, and related geometries. But today, I'm just going to lay the groundwork. So I'm not going to talk about complex or symplectic geometry, and I'm not going to talk about generalized Taylor geometry either. I'm only going to talk about some more primitive underlying geometry, which is important to understand first. So, is this thing annoying? It's making a kind of... Can you still hear me?
Yeah.
I don't think I really need this microphone. But... Okay, so let's begin by... the general kind of place where all this geometry happens is on the tangent and the cotangent bundle of the manifold. So you take a manifold and you form its tangent bundle and you sum on its cotangent bundle, then this kind of is a larger place to do geometry than just the tangent bundle. Usually you're used to using just a tangent bundle. You put a complex structure on it or a symplectic structure. So for generalized complex Taylor or Calabi-Yau or even generalized Gifu or spin-7 manifolds, it's all happening here. The first thing I want to do is just consider the linear algebra associated with a space like this, which is composed of a vector space and a dual. Okay, so instead of this, let's just begin with E being a real, let's say, 2n-dimensional vector space. And let's suppose that it has an inner product of signature 0. Or a signature n, comma n. Okay. So in particular, if we took a vector space and summed with its dual, then here, if I took a vector x and a one-form psi, then this is equipped with a natural pairing of signature nn, because we can just pair v up to v sub. So for example, if we take the pairing of x and psi with another element of this vector space, y plus eta, then I'm just going to take the pairing to be the evaluation of psi on y and eta on x. So if anyone doesn't understand any of my notation, just let me know. But here, we see that anytime you take a vector space, and this is called the double, you're just summing with its dual, this becomes one of these. It has a natural signature n, comma n metric. Okay, so when you have such a structure, such a vector space, there are some special submanifolds. Right? Usually, if you have a metric of full signature, let's say a positive definite metric, then there aren't really any distinguished submanifolds. Anytime you have a submanifold, they restrict it to its positive definite. So they're all somehow equivalent. But when you have this kind of metric, then things are a bit different. There are special submanifolds, or special sub-vector spaces, sub-spaces. Okay. So suppose we have a subspace of E. Then we say that, so what are some of the possibilities? So first of all, A could be positive definite. It could be, let's say, definite. And there's 2 kinds of definite, you have positive and negative definite. This just means that when you restrict this metric to A, it's either positive or negative definite. And in this case, if we take the orthogonal complement of A, then it's disjoint from it. Okay, so for example, if we have, if you think in terms of signature n comma n, then it looks kind of like a Lorentz metric, right? So you have the light cone, right? And inside it has a positive definite. And if you have a positive definite space, then if you take it's orthogonal complement, right, then it will be disjoint from it. Whereas if you took something that has some null directions, then it's orthogonal complementary intersect, right? So in particular, suppose that we have the perpendicular of A, or let's say A is contained inside A perpendicular, right? That means that if we take anything A and take the metric pairing with anything else in A, we'll get zero. So this means that A is isotropic. And we could have A contains its perpendicular, and this means it's co-isotropic. The same terminology is used for this situation. For this is a signature NN, it's a symmetric Fellinger form. The same terminology is used when you have an anti-symmetric Fellinger form. Okay. And then, of course, the intersection of these two conditions is that A is equal to its orthogonal complement. And this means that A is Lagrangian. Or since we're in the symmetric category, instead of Lagrangian, sometimes it's called maximal isotropic. So, for example, let's look at the case of V plus V star. So, if this space is exactly this one, V plus V star, then take a look at the pairing on V. The pairing on V vanishes because we have no psi or A. So that means that both V and V star are null. So we have V and V star both null. Or another way, and if we take the orthogonal complement of V, since V is half-dimensional, then the orthogonal complement is exactly itself. So that means that V and V dual are both Lagrangians inside here. So this is a Lagrangian splitting. So V plus V star is a splitting into two Lagrangians. So it's sometimes called polarization. Okay. So suppose that now we had a positive definite subspace. Let's call it C plus. So if it was maximal dimension, so this would be dimension n. This would be dimension n. These are all n-dimensional. So the maximum possible positive definite is n, right? And then that determines right away its orthogonal complement, C plus orthogonal complement, which is negative definite. Okay. Now, notice that, okay, because this is positive definite and these both are null, right, then that means that the intersection of this space with either one of these two is zero. Because if you can't have an intersection, everything here is non-positive and everything here is non-zero. So that means that C plus can actually be expressed as a graph of a map from V to V star. So for example, if we had a map, suppose we had a map from A from V to V star, right, then we could take the graph of A, and here we see that this is, so whenever we have a positive definite, it determines a map A. So if for any point in V, you just project onto C plus, and then you project down to V star. And because the intersections are zero, this is a well-defined map. Okay. And so if the graph of this map is the C plus, then there has to be some special condition on it, right? Because if we took the graph of any map, there would be no great guarantee that it would be positive definite. So let's say C positive definite. Positive implies that this map is positive definite. And then for any positive definite map, you can construct positive definite to C plus. So what does this mean? This just means that A XX is greater than zero for all X on zero. So anytime we have a positive definite map from here to here, we get a C plus, vice versa. So, but what is such a map? So, such a map A is just inside V dual tensor V dual in order to be such a map. And so we can break up A into a symmetric and an anti-symmetric. So let's say we call G the symmetric and V the anti-symmetric. So this is in symmetric to V star plus wedge to V star. So any such positive definite, we can break it up into symmetric and anti-symmetric. And then this condition that A has to be positive definite, is only a condition on the symmetric component of it. So, and this, I'll put a plus here, which indicates that it has to be positive definite. So that means that the space, so if you the space of sim plus is the same as sim 2 plus d star plus wedge 2 d star. That's what one is here. Now, in string theory, in various parts of physics, it's natural, or it occurs very naturally, that a metric always comes together with an anti-symmetric tuple. And this is one way to realize that. So this is called a generalized metric. So this is C plus becomes a generalized metric. Now, those are not the only, what else can we do with this plus? So we have this G plus D. So we have C plus, and we have C minus, which is the orthogonal complement. Now, we know that the natural metric on B plus D star is a signature N comma N. But now we've chosen a C plus. So, for example, we could consider a metric G, a metric, on the whole space, U plus V star, which is just the metric, the natural metric on C plus, minus the natural metric on C minus. So that means that the natural metric here is positive and here is negative. So we just switch the sign here, and we get a positive definite metric. So signature 2N0. And so this defines a metric on the double. And we could say that this reduces structure. From O n comma n down to O n cross O n. So what do I mean by that? Well, the natural metric on B plus B star gives you an orthogonal structure O n comma n. If you want the T duality group on this space. But then when we choose the positive definite, it breaks the symmetry so that it has to preserve C plus and C minus. So on C plus you get an ON, and on C minus you get another ON. So this is the choice of C plus, which determines this reduction.
What
is
the G duality there?
Well, this group is the G duality group, right? ON comma N. Maybe if you wait for my third lecture, then I'll explain exactly what has to do with G duality. Okay, so right. So here, okay. Now, let's say we want to write down what this metric is. So suppose we write down what is the metric on B plus D star, on B plus D star. We could write it in this way. So if B was equal to zero, okay, then it would be very simple because the metric on, let's say, x plus psi, y plus theta, would just be the usual Riemannian metric on x and y plus the inverse on psi and eta for the 1/2. So that's the simple case when C plus is the graph of just a symmetric two form. So it's just the graph of a Riemannian metric. And then, so how would the metric look? It would look like this. Let's write it this way, g inverse x plus psi, y plus theta. Okay, where this is the natural metric of just pairing. Right? So here what it means is, what I mean by this is that this matrix is acting here. So the action here is just g x plus G inverse psi, okay? And then when I take the pairing with y plus theta, this is the one form, and I just get G of xy plus G inverse psi theta. I'm just emphasizing this because I'm going to use this kind of notation a lot. I'm looking at it as a matrix acting on V plus V star. Okay. So what that means is that so that's the simple case when V is equal to 0, the case we kind of already understand. But when V is not equal to 0, then it perturbs what the metric G looks like. So I'll write that here. Right away we turn into the question of how does V act? Well, okay, so now I'm going to tell you that's a fact. So there's an action of wedge to V star on V plus V star. So what is this action? Well, it's very simple. We know that V plus V star is an orthogonal space. And the Lie algebra of V plus V star is just wedge 2 of V plus V star, right? It's just the anti-symmetric matrices on V plus V star. And inside here, we have wedge 2 V star. Well, we also have wedge 2 V, and we also have the endomorphisms of V. These are all sitting inside wedge 2 of this space. Okay? So that means that bivectors, two forms, and endomorphisms are all acting via the Lie algebra on this space. And let's see what that action is, because we're going to need this action many times. So how does let's call this component theta, this component V, and this component A. So an element of this Lie algebra looks like theta A joule V. Theta and V. So I've written it as a matrix here, so that it acts on x plus psi in this way. So that's a general element of the orthogonal Lie algebra.
Can you do something about that microphone, please?
So is this being recorded?
I think it was just knocking against something loose. Or,
Might be a bad connection. Switch off the speakers and just go for the static cluster.
Yeah, I don't think I can. Is that? Okay, well, if it does it again, I'll just turn the thing off. Okay, so. Okay, so this is an element of the Lie algebra, okay, and we can see that. So, for example, if we just concentrate on the action of B, right? Okay, it sends x plus psi to just B acting on x. Okay. Or what I mean by this is just the interior product of the vector with the two forms. So this gives me a one form. Okay. So this is the natural action, the natural way in which two form will act on this space. Okay. So before we looked at the case where B was equal to zero, and we just had this metric. But now what we'd like to do is use one of these B field transformations, one of these B transformations, to modify G into G plus B. So how do you do that? Well, the first thing you want is to exponentiate this Lie algebra element to get an orthogonal element. Right? So E to the B, how does it act on X plus psi? Well, it's just, first of all, the identity plus this matrix plus higher powers, but they all vanish because this is nilpotent. So this is this acting on X plus psi. So it's just x plus psi plus ix psi, ix b. Or another way to see it is if you look, think in terms of V and V star, then given a point in V plus V star, when we act by this exponential of the two form, it takes this and changes the V star component. So it's a shear in the V star direction. So this is the action of E to the B. So in particular, if we had started with C plus, which was just the graph of a Riemannian metric, G, right? Here it is. Then what we could do is act on this subspace in V plus V star, act on it by a B field transformation, B, okay? And that would change the V star component into, let's say, so all I'm saying is that E to the B applied to C plus, which is, let's say, the graph of G, is just going to give the graph of G plus B. Very simple fact that we can just use one of these orthogonal transformations to take C plus and move it over. And because the transformation is orthogonal, it preserves the condition that this thing is a positive definite subspace. So that tells us what the metric should look like. So let's say, so now, now that we know how to get from G to G plus B, all we have to do is conjugate by E to the B. Times G to the inverse and E to the minus B, acting on X, X by Y plus eta. So all we have to do is conjugate this matrix. And this is exactly the following matrix. So here, again, the notation that I'm using is that a Riemannian metric, you can think of it as a map from V to V star, okay, just by taking interior product. And also, a two-form V can also be represented as a map this way. So here, what I mean is this map is just G, and then also V composed with G inverse composed with V. So whenever you have a metric and a two-form, you can do all kinds of fancy games of applying the metric, or applying the two-form, inverting the metric, and then applying the two-form again, et cetera, producing these things. And because there are two B's here, this is also symmetric, and this is also a symmetric. Or I guess another way of saying this is that, let's call this the metric G. So any generalized metric looks like this. And in particular, just note that if we take G and we restrict it to the tangent bundle, or to V, right, then what does it look like? Well, this is acting on X plus psi and pairing with Y plus eta. So the component that is, here, this is acting on X plus psi. So this component is the one that's taking X to a one form, and then it's going to be paired with Y. So this object is actually the restriction to V. So this is G minus B, G minus B. In particular, this thing defines a Riemannian metric on V. So, it may seem a bit bizarre, but as soon as you choose a C plus, this C plus is the graph of G plus B. And this G plus B determines a somewhat bizarre metric on B plus B star. And then we can take that metric and restrict it to B itself, and we get this this kind of B field transformation of a metric in this way. And just for entertainment, we could compute the volume form of this metric. So let's say the volume form determined by this big metric G. This is a volume form in the determinant of V star. Okay. So how do you find a volume form? Well, whenever you have a map from V to V star, positive definite, then you just take the determinant of this map. So let's say this is G, well, let's call this G, say, or, I don't know, A. And the determinant of A goes from determinant B to determinant B star, right? Which means that determinant of A is an element inside determinant B star squared. Right? So we can take the square root, because it's positive definite, we can take the square root of A. So let's say we want to know what that metric is, I mean, what that volume form is. So the volume form determined by this generalized metric G is just the determinant of this bizarre metric G minus B, G inverse B. Right, but that's just the determinant of G. Let's take a G out of here, times 1 minus G inverse B, G inverse B. Determinant of this, determinant of G, and then take the square root of this. This is the square root.
So we're computing a volume form, so we take the map, and then we take its determinant and take its square root. So just pulling out a determinant of G from there, we just hit this, okay? And this is just equal to determinant of G, G plus B. So here we can see that this is just G inverse B squared. So determinant of G. Okay, so that's the volume form. Just to show you that you get these familiar factors coming out when you consider this generalized metric restricted to B. And we'll see this volume form coming up a little bit later. So are there any questions about the linear algebra? I mean, everything I've done so far is linear algebra of a vector space summing with its dual, and just concentrating on the positive definite subspaces. Positive definite subspaces give you generalized metrics, and then these generalized metrics determine you these additional structures. Any questions?
Sure. This G restricted to B
yeah.
is always positive definite.
Because G itself is positive definite on B plus B star.
It's probably has to do with what supposed to be means, so the anti-symmetry that minus infinite cancels out.
Yeah, so you can I'll leave it as an exercise to show that, yeah, this is positive definite for any 2-point B because of the fact that it's an anti-symmetric 2-point. Okay. Now, so far I've only spoken about these positive definites, but there are other special subspaces, these Lagrangian ones, for example. And I should say that I should say the following: that what does this? Well, okay, yeah. So let's do the next case. We're done with this. So generalized metric, that's what a generalized metric is. Very simple concept. But now let's consider Lagrangians inside B plus B star, or even inside some B. Second point. So these are sometimes called linear Dirac structures. And these were introduced by Courant. Well, I mean, these have always been around, obviously, but the intensive study of them as a geometric object was done by Courant and Weinstein. And a lot of the tools that they developed are useful in this generalized world. I mean, we use results from Poisson geometry as developed by this group all the time. Okay. But all I want to say is that suppose that we take E and we split it up as a positive definite plus its orthogonal complement. So now we have E being written as C, C plus plus C minus. So now, consider a Lagrangian. Well, a Lagrangian is going to be given by a subspace, which must be, again, it must be perpendicular, it must be complementary to both C plus and C minus. They have zero intersection, which means that L can be written as the graph of a map A, where A is mapping from C minus to C plus.
So when you say C minus, you always
assume... I always assume C minus is C plus all the perpendicular. Yeah. All the time. Although in this particular example, it's not important. But all I'm saying is that it's easy to understand what Lagrangians look like when you choose a splitting to positive definites. Okay. And the reason is that, okay, so if we take a map, suppose we have a map from C minus to C plus, what does it mean for the graph of A to be Lagrangian? Well, this happens if and only if A is an orthogonal map. So, for example, I mean, if we have an orthogonal map from here to here, by which I mean, you know, here, this has a negative metric, this has a positive definite metric, so just switch the sign of this and consider an orthogonal map, then the graph of that is going to have things which have some positive norm and some negative norm, and those norms will be equal because it's an orthogonal transformation, right? So that means the graph has to be null. It has to have non-zero. So that's why the Lagrangians correspond to orthogonal maps. Okay, so if E is dimension 2n again, then the space of all Lagrangians is equal to, is isomorphic to, the space of all orthogonal maps. So it's going to look like an O(n). So we have this fact that Lagrangians in an O comma n comma n space form a variety which looks like the orthogonal group in half dimension. So in particular, it has two connected components, and we call them even and odd. Although so far, I haven't given you any extra structure which distinguishes one component from the other. I mean, they're just two components. One of them is called even, the other is called odd. Right, okay. So now we kind of understand what these Lagrangians are like. We know what the Lagrangians look like and what the positive definites look like. And but there's an important kind of classical theory of these Lagrangians. This theory tells us that Lagrangians in such a space are in one-to-one correspondence with pure spinners. So the next thing I want to do is explain what are pure spinners. What are spinners? I mean, in this context, what are spinners? So one comment that I want to make, first of all, is that whenever we have such a space E, then we can always split it into, we can always find a polarization. So that's always possible. These are both Lagrangians, and they are, this sum is direct. So, but the interesting thing is that the metric induces an isomorphism from N to P dual. Right? Since P is Lagrangian, that means that if we take the inner product of anything not in P and take the inner product of P, then we'll get some non-zero result. So that means that here, if we have P and N, the inner product of anything in N with P is non-zero. So N is isomorphic to the dual of P. So when we consider these spaces that are the sums of vector space as dual, this is kind of an important generic kind of condition. I mean, any polarization would immediately mean N is isomorphic to P dual. Anyway, just as a comment. Okay. So now we want to understand spinners. And there's a very a nice construction of Cartan, which explains in such a situation what are the centers. So we know that, so let's form the Clifford algebra, the Clifford algebra of E. Right? This is signature NN, so this is just CL N comma N, and you can check that this is just matrices, real matrices, which are 2 to the N by 2 to the N. Just in the classification of Clifford algebras, very simple Clifford algebra, just a matrix algebra. Okay, but actually, what we're going to see is that this is actually naturally isomorphic to the endomorphism algebra. So here we know that it's matrices, but what is this 2n-dimensional space? Is there a natural one lying around? Well, if we choose a polarization, then the claim is that this is naturally the endomorphisms of this space, which is 2 to the n dimensional. So this is a classical result, and I'll explain, it's very simple to see why this is true. Why is that true? The reason is that, suppose that we have x plus psi inside E, or let's say inside P plus P dual, okay? Then we want to, now suppose that we look at this inside the Clifford algebra. Okay? So I'm just going to tell you how this element is acting on exterior algebra P dual. So suppose that we have rho inside this space. Then we define x plus psi acting on rho in the following way. Just this is a vector in P. This is in the exterior algebra. So we can take the interior product by x on rho, and we can take the exterior product by psi. Okay. And it's very simple to see that if we square this, if we act on it twice, then this interior product is going to act here, and we're going to get the pairing of x on psi. So here what we get is just the norm of x plus psi squared times rho, where this norm is in the natural metric. Because the natural metric is just pairing vectors on one forms. Okay? So here we see that there's an action, and when we square it, we get exactly the norm. So this is the defining condition of Clifford algebra. So this extends to the Clifford algebra of the acting on this space. And this is the spin representation. So these are spinners. So S plus minus is equal to the even or odd forms on P. So this is a very important fact, and this is the means by which, so when Nigel spoke about differential forms determining geometry, the point of view is that differential forms could be thought of as being spinners for a larger space E, which is not just P, but P plus its dual, okay? And when you consider differential forms as being spinners for this group, then what that means is that you have a much larger group of symmetries acting on it. Because before, when you think of differential forms, you just say, take wedge K of some vector space, take a K form, and then you act on it by a general linear GLN. But now we're thinking of not wedge K, but we're thinking of, let's say, all the even forms. And on all the even forms, there's a Clifford algebra of a 2n-dimensional space acting. And we saw that the Lie algebra here contains endomorphisms of the vector space. So GLN is sitting inside this symmetry group, but there's more stuff. There's this and this and all the compositions, and those extend your symmetry algebra to this larger algebra. So that means that somehow forms can be, you can take a K-form and then act on it so that it becomes not only a K-form but a sum of multi-degree forms. Right? And this is just because you're viewing all differential forms as being acted on by the Clifford algebra. You're thinking of them as spinners. Okay.
question.
Any question about that?
So you can talk about spinner abstractly, but when you physically define a spinner, there's more constraint on the manifold. So the manifold node,
so
it has to be identical as well as the spin.
Well, you're talking about the theory of Riemannian spinners. So that means, suppose we take a metric on a manifold, and then we want spinners for that metric. So that's a metric on the tangent bundle, right? So then the theory of spin for the tangent bundle is, as you said, you need it to be orientable at spin.
Yeah.
But here we're talking about not a vector space, or you should think of this as the tangent bundle, not the tangent bundle, but the sum of t plus t star. And we're not choosing a Riemannian metric. It has a metric already on t plus t star. Okay? So there's still a question. You might say, well, we have this bundle, which has fibers, a vector space, plus a dual. And you might say, well, OK, we have a metric, but how do we know that that is liftable to a spin structure? Okay? So the theory of the obstruction for spin is different in the case of an n comma n signature metric. Okay, it's not just that it has to be spin, but there's a more subtle criterion, and that's always satisfied for any differentiable manifold. So
the general property is trivial.
Yeah.
I see.
Yeah. No, it's just a different kind of metric, so it's a different kind of spin condition. So the condition is just I'm not talking about that now, so I can talk about it later. But the condition is not that W2 has to vanish. So it turns out that on any manifold, this thing has a spin structure. One way to see that is that I've already defined you the spin bundle. Right? The spin bundle is differential forms, and I've showed you what the action is. So there's no question that there's a spin. There's a spin bundle. You see?
Well, provided that there is a global choice of Brownians.
And so if we just notice the tangent bundle itself is the Brownian. And T star, the code tangent bundle is Lagrangian.
Okay.
Then, yeah, you have that. But that's a good point. You have to make sure that that's the case. It's just that it's given to you for free as being already polarized. So anyway, it's just a point of view that the differential forms or forms on a vector space could be viewed as spinners for this larger metric. Now, once you have the spin representation, then you can. Oh, here it is. Let's see here. Okay, so once you have the spin representation, then you might ask, well, what structure? Let's say we fix a spinner. What structure is determined by that spinner? Or what can we notice about the spinner? Well, just notice the following thing. Suppose that we have some spinner. Okay. Then consider the annihilator of the spinner. So consider the annihilator, which is just the set of all x plus psi inside p plus p star, such that when we act on rho, it vanishes. So x plus psi acting on rho equals zero. So any spinner has an annihilator. And then just notice the following fact that if we have, suppose we want to look at the norm of x plus psi. Suppose x plus psi is in there, right? Then we know that the norm squared acting on rho is the same as x plus psi acting twice on rho, because it's the spin representation, but we know this is zero. So suppose that we took a non-zero spinner, formed its annihilator, then for any x plus psi inside this annihilator, okay, the norm has to be zero. So that means that this annihilator is isotropic.
I think we see that there's always an annihilator.
Well, I'm just saying, the annihilator could be zero, just to zero, but that's the smallest case. So if you think about the space of isotropics, first there's zero, then there's some isotropic null directions, just one-dimensional spaces, two-dimensional, etc., all the way up to half-dimensional. So that means that These annihilators could have different dimensions, right? So it has dimensions. It could be inside, let's say, 0, 1, all the way up to n. That's the maximal isotropic. That's the Lagrangian case. Okay. So then they just say that so it's Lagrangian if and only if rho is pure. That's the definition of a pure spinner. Pure spinner is that the annihilator of the spinner is as big as it possibly can be. So if you have such a pure spinner, right, then we know that there's an orthogonal group action on Lagrangians. So here we have the On acting. And here we have the pin group acting. And this is an equivariant thing. So if we have a spinner, we can act orthogonally, get another pure spinner. Okay, that's the same as the Lagrangian, the annihilator. It's going to be the orthogonal group acting on that. So it's a very simple observation that is useful because sometimes it's better to think represent Lagrangians as just a differential form. It's so much easier to just give a differential form than to specify some kind of subspace. Okay. Okay. So let me give you an example of a pure spinner. So we're going to consider E to have a polarization. Okay. Now I'll give you an examples of pure spinners. Okay. So the first example is just one, which is inside the exterior algebra. Okay. What's the annihilator of 1? What's the annihilator?
N.
Sorry?
Say that N or P.
Okay, so P or P star. So remember that P acts by interior product, and P star acts by exterior product. So what is going to kill 1? Contraction with P, so this is just P. So anything in P, of course, when we take it to a product, we get 0. So we have 1 already. So now we're going to get another 1. Well, we know that we can act by an orthogonal transformation, right? So one possible orthogonal transformation, go back to the Lie algebra here. Okay, so if you take one of these elements, B, right. Then we saw that B acts on T plus T star by just taking a vector to the interior product of B. So how does B act on spinners? Okay. Or actually, let me just tell you how the whole how this whole algebra element acts on spinners. How does this act on spinners? Well, it's very simple. So there's three components, A, B, and beta. So the way that A acts is by minus A dual plus 1/2 the trace of A applied to the spinner. Okay, so this is just a number, and this is just the dual of the linear transformation, which acts on any any form. Okay, so the way that B acts is just by wedging with B. And the way that beta acts is by taking interior product of beta. So anytime I have a true form, the way that it acts in the Lie algebra representation on the spinners is just by wedging this spinner, which is inside here, by B. And this is how the other components act. Okay. So if we want to take that pure spinner and we want to move it around to get another pure spinner, then what do we have to do? Well, take a Lie algebra element, exponentiate it so that it's something in the spin group, in the orthogonal group, and then apply it to one, which is our first example. So for example, the exponential of b acting on one is just one plus b wedge one plus b wedge one over two plus da da da. So in other words, it's just e to the b inside the exterior algebra. Okay. So that means that this is another case spinner. Okay. Does anyone see how that works? This is just the same example as the first one, acted on by a spin element. Notice that here, when we exponentiated the two form in the first time, it stopped after this because it was nilpotent, right? The matrix was just 0b0, right? Now, when you use a different representation, okay, the thing is different. So here, it's not getting killed at the first step. You have to wedge a few times, but then eventually it will get killed because any time you have something which is nilpotent, it's nilpotent in any representation. So the thing that changes is how many times you have to apply it to become nilpotent, to become zero. Okay. So this is just a different representation, but the same element in the real algebra. Okay. All right, so that's a second example of a pure spinner. But let me give you another one. So suppose that we have omega. Here's another example. Omega, let's say it's a decomposable k-form. Theta 1 wedge, theta 2 wedge, up to theta k. Decomposable k-form. Then the annihilator. So first of all, this whole k-form has a kernel. So the kernel, which is going to be an n minus k, this is an n minus k dimensional space. Okay, it's just all vectors which are killed by this k-form. Okay, so the annihilator of this spinner is exactly, first of all, the kernel of this omega, because when we interior product by k, we get zero. Okay, plus the space spanned by these thetas. Okay, because if we wedge with one of these thetas on omega, we get zero. So it wedges to zero. So this is n minus k, and this is k. So this is Lagrangian, which means that this thing is pure. So that's pure. Okay, and I've almost given you every pure spinner that exists, because the only thing left to do is given a pure spinner omega k, okay, then we can act on it by one of these B field transformations. Okay, that's going to be pure as well, and then we can just multiply by a constant. Okay, and then we get this. This is any pure. This is the general pure spinner. So this is theorem of Chevalier in his book, Algebraic Theory of Spinners. It's very easy to show.
The example, the first example, what's the annihilator you see?
So what's the annihilator? So remember that this relationship between the Lagrangian annihilator and the pure spinner is equivariant. So here, we see that a B-field transform was applied to one to get this pure spinner, which means that we just have to do a B-field transform to the annihilator of one, and we'll get the annihilator of this thing. So that's just, if we have P and P star, and we do a B-field transform on this, where does P get sent? It just gets sent to the graph of B. So the graph of B is a Lagrangian, and that's exactly going to be the annihilator of this. So we can just see, this is just a set of x plus ixb. I should write minus ixb, graph of minus b. Okay. So if we take interior product by x and exterior product by minus ixb, then this will get killed by that. Okay. So, and in particular, the annihilator of this general spinner is just a set of x plus psi, such that X is in the kernel of omega, and when we take psi and restrict it to the kernel, then we get IXB. So the annihilator obviously does not depend on multiplication by a constant. I mean, this is why the correspondence is really between, let's set it precisely, Lagrangians. The set of Lagrangians is in one-to-one correspondence with pure spindle lines, or another way of saying it is, that's a good enough way of saying it. So lines in the pure spindles. If I give you a maximal isotropic, it'll determine the line. It won't determine this constant, right? You can choose this. Okay. All right, so I don't have much time left. But what I'd like to say is that, okay, so let me say the following thing. So let me quickly move to a manifold, and now, so far we understand these positive definites, and we understand the Lagrangians, and that's about all I'm going to use in all the lectures. Each one will correspond to a special kind of structure. Okay, but let's say we now move to T plus T star. Okay. And the spinners for this are just, as I showed before, the exterior points. Okay. So and let's consider a generalized metric. Which is a Riemannian metric plus an anti-symmetric two-form. And I'm not assuming B is not closed in general. And so when we do this, what this means is that we're choosing this C plus, which is a subbundle of T plus T star. Okay. And so what that means is that the Clifford algebra of this positive definite space is sitting inside the Clifford algebra of T plus T star. And in particular, we have a volume element in here. So the volume element, let's say A1, AN for some orthonormal basis of C plus, let's call the volume element star. It's a volume element. C plus. So it's just a top form on C plus. And if you think about the way that spinners work, we have this decomposition C plus and C minus, right? And this is the product of an orthonormal basis of C plus. So let's say AI, an orthonormal basis for C plus. So according to the spinner representation, when you have a product of unit vectors like this, then you should say what it's doing orthogonally is that it's reflecting in all these things. So it's reflecting in A1, in A2, and all the way up to AN. Which means that this whole space C plus is being reflected above the origin, and this C minus is left alone. So the transformation that that corresponds to this is just a transformation which is minus one on C plus and plus one on C minus. Right? This is the element inside the orthogonal group, which this element in the Clifford algebra corresponds to. So this is an element inside the pin group, and then it maps down to this element in the orthogonal group. But this element is exactly minus G, where G is that Riemannian metric on T plus T star that I had before. Okay. So remember that we defined this metric. So this is equal to minus G. So. I'll leave it as an exercise to see that star element is actually covering the generalized metric G that we defined before. But I'll just keep using star So note that if we take star, so note the following thing, that sigma star is, sigma is a map which just switches everything around. So this is AN product all the way to A1. And notice that star sigma star is equal to 1. This is the inverse, so sigma star is star inverse. Star sigma is a map that acts on spinners by just flipping everything. And also, if we take the square, and this is minus 1 to the n, n minus 1 over 2, it's one of those formulas of flipped algebras. But consider the following operation on spinners. So suppose that these are both spinners. So these are both inside exterior algebra of P star. Then there's a natural bilinear pairing of these two things, which is just taking the wedge product of one with the reversal of the other, and then taking the top degree. So this is the nth degree part. So usually you think of a pairing on differential forms by just taking one and wedging with another one up to the top degree. But here what I'm asking you to do is to reverse the order of this form. So for example, depending if it was on acting on degree k, then it would be acting by minus 1 to the k minus 1 over 2. Okay. But this pairing is important because this is a spin invariant. Okay. So in particular, for example, we could see that the pairing of e to the b with e to the b, right, is the same as e to the b wedge. When we reverse e to the b, we're just going to be reversing the order of b, so we're going to get e to the minus b, right, and this is equal to 1, which is the same as, for example, e to the minus b, e to the b pairing with 1. So I'm just showing that if you have a transformation in spin, you can just take it over to the other side. This is an invariant pairing. But the important thing to notice about that pairing is that it's not symmetric, because if we reverse the order, we get a factor minus 1 to the n minus 1 over 2 times psi phi. So what I'm saying is that on these differential forms, there's a natural pairing into the determinant, which is spin invariant, but it's not symmetric. Okay. So what we could do is we could just correct it by adding this metric. So consider this. This is we'll call it the Born-Infeld pairing. Okay. And don't worry, I won't go too much over time, because we started a little bit late. I'll go to 5 more minutes. So so because this had this factor and this star squares to the same factor, by putting this, so this is coming from the generalized metric, so I wouldn't be able to do this unless I chose a generalized metric. It depends on g plus b. So this satisfies, so let's call this, well, it satisfies the following thing. It's symmetric. Okay. Or maybe a better way to see it is that. So it's equal to, let's say, star phi star sigma phi psi. I'll just say that. So this is symmetric. Okay. So we'll just what we'll do is we'll say let it equal some symmetric number depending on some symmetric function depending on these two things times some volume point. So this is going to be, this is always, since we always take the highest power, this is always going to be a volume form. So just extract a volume form and define this symmetric pairing so that G of 1, 1 is equal to 1. Okay. So what I'm saying is that using the generalized metric, we can produce a symmetric expression in these two spinners. And then take out a volume form so that the symmetric thing that remains has this normalization factor. Okay. And this volume form turns out to be exactly the volume form determined by that generalized metric that we defined before. Okay. So here we have, so this is just a symmetric pairing, an actual symmetric bilinear form on these spinners, determined by the generalized metric. And because we see this volume form, which has the square root of the determinant g plus b, I call it the Born-Imfeld volume and the Born-Imfeld pairing here. Okay. But the nice thing to notice about this is that if b was 0, okay, then this is just nothing but the Hodge pairing. So this Born-Imfeld is exactly phi wedge star phi which is just the usual metric pairing of phi and psi times the volume of G. So that means that we know about this pairing. This is the Hodge pairing, so this is a positive definite metric. And then by simply acting by the B field, we can get to this condition. Since it's a deformation, this is also a positive definite. Okay. So that means that by giving a generalized metric, the important thing is that given a generalized metric, this naturally determines a positive definite pairing on the spinners, on differential forms, which is a deformation of the usual Hodge pairing. Right? So that means that now if we do Hodge theory, using this pairing, we're going to get some slightly different results. And, I think I could end there, or if you give me 5 minutes, I could finish the Hodge theory question. What does the organizer say? Okay, thank you. So given this pairing, we can try to do some Hodge theory. So how do you do Hodge theory? So remember that Hodge theory says that as soon as you give me a Riemannian metric, then any cohomology class has a unique harmonic representative for a compact metric. So that means that giving a metric gives you harmonic representatives for cohomology. Now, let's consider homology, but on a generalized metric instead of a normal metric. And instead of considering usual homology, let's spice it up a little bit and not consider the Durham cohomology, but the cohomology where we're wedging with a free form. So let's say H is a closed free form. And this operator, let's call it dh, dh squares to 0 because h is a free form and h is closed. So that means that we could try to figure out the Durham cohomology of this operator. So this is called, so the dh is called twisted cohomology. And this is relevant whenever you have this Miller-Schwarz three form flux. And you could do the same for any closed odd form. So this could be any odd form, and what I'm going to say is goes over without change. Okay. Then, as soon as we have this operator, we could take the adjoint of this operator, the adjoint using this pairing. And it's an interesting exercise to show that the adjoint is actually star dh star inverse. So this is slightly different from the Riemannian case, because in the Riemannian case, you have all these nasty signs in front of this equation. If you take the adjoint, you can have all these weird signs. But when we think of this star operation, it's a slightly modified Hodge star, right, with this reversal, and the reversal takes care of all the signs. So if you do things with this Hodge star, you don't have to worry about any signs, it's just a very simple adjoint. Okay. So this adjoint, and then we can form the Laplacian of this operator, which is just dH plus dH star squared. Okay. And then we can consider, and this is an elliptic operator. And again, you can kind of think of why, because it starts off as being the usual Riemannian one, but it's modified by this trig one in some way, some nonlinear way. So this elliptic operator, it's a Laplacian operator, so we could consider the so in the same way that we had Hodge theory, you have the following result. It's a very easy result. It's just saying that any twisted cohomology class has a unique twisted harmonic representative. So harmonic. Okay. So here we have a manifold with a metric and a two-form and an odd form, which is the background field, if you want. So this background field gives us a topological cohomology of M, this twisted cohomology. And the presence of this G plus D means that we get these DH harmonic classes, harmonic elements. Okay. And what I just want to emphasize is that here, you could apply, so let's say I give you a two-form, then this two-form acts on everything in sight. Right? You can change B, so M, G, B plus B prime. Okay. And if we modify H by H minus DB, DB prime, okay, then this is a commutative square, I guess. So that's the last thing I'll write, but I'll just explain this. I'll just say that. So here we have a background field and some metric data. And here we have a different background field and different metric data, which is related to this one by a B field transformation, where B is not necessarily close. I'm not assuming anything about the closure of B. Okay. But the important thing is that anytime I have a harmonic element here, I can map it to a harmonic element here. And so what this means is that there's a kind of gauge transformation acting on this data. Right? So if I give you a metric with this background, I could consider a different metric and a different background, but there's an explicit mapping of T plus T star and the spinners and the differential forms, which kind of take you from this situation to that situation. But notice that this is not changing the cohomology of class of H. So no matter which one you pick, it computes the twisted cohomology. So compute the twisted cohomology choosing any metric background that you want. Okay, so I'll just leave it at that, and tomorrow I'll speak about using some of the Lagrangians and considering generalized complex geometry and Dirac geometry. Okay, thanks for your attention. Questions.
I guess you lose your grading on the cohomology.
Yeah, so this this is graded even odd. That's it. Since H is odd, H is degree 3, D is degree 1, so yeah, you lose your grading, but you still have set to grade. I mean, another thing that happens when you have a background like this is you have twisted K theory. I mean, all these cohomology theories can be twisted. And then, yeah, so, right here.
Any more questions? So, when you say J cohomology is harmonic, what do you mean? Do you require that, or?
Which one, sir?
When you say it, it's G comma P.
Yeah, so here I just mean, you mean to this?
Yeah.
I just mean that if you have this, right, then harmonic elements are, you know, the kernel of this operator is defined. Okay. This operator depends on B, G, and H, okay? And so it has a kernel. It's a kernel inside the differential points. So that kernel, by this e to the b, this exponentiation, which is a weird thing where you just